I love this poem because it's so stoic on one side at the beginning. Nothing's happening. Something's stuck. It's still. It's stopped. It's permanent. But then when you go into the silence, you could begin to hear the waves. And when you can hear the, perceive the waves and the movement, you can see that there's the possibility that maybe something new is happening. It's in that perception of impermanence, not the knowing of impermanence intellectually, but the perceiving of impermanence that becomes so important. And when we can perceive impermanence, we open the door for the possibility of being liberated in a moment. So if you think of suffering, all of our difficulties, as being stuck in some place where I can't get out, and somehow in the perceiving of impermanence, the perceiving of changing nature, then I can find my way out, a new way of perceiving the moment. So how is it that we could perceive impermanence? I mean, we all know impermanence. It's not like we don't know. It's not like we don't know things change. We know things change. Okay, I got it. Not a big deal. You don't have to shout it on the rooftops. We know. We can see it theoretically. But what we don't perceive about impermanence that I think the Buddha was pointing to is the lawfulness of impermanence, the absoluteness of impermanence, the continuous, constant nature of impermanence. So it's not that impermanence happens every once in a while. Impermanence happens constantly. And that there is no permanency that we can hold on to. And any permanency that we are holding on to is more than likely habit. And we are putting the habit in front of us as a thing that makes us feel and see this permanency. I have seen impermanence, and it is quite destabilizing. It has its own limitations to it. As wise as it can bring, the wisdom it can bring, it also brings a level of too much. And I have seen permanency, and there's a bit of good in that too. But at the same time, it's full of limitations. And so what I think as lay practitioners contemplating the nature of death and impermanence, we are not trying to live only in the impermanence world. We are trying to learn to live in the both worlds. Both in the world of permanency and the world of impermanency. This world of knowing that we can live in this world of permanency, but know that it is a distortion of the true nature of life, which is very, very impermanent and constantly moving. But there's something stabilizing about the world of permanency, of thinking and envisioning things as being permanent. What I think for householders, what I was talking about last week, when we start thinking about practicing with this, is we want to bring the nature of impermanency into our everyday life. So that when we get trapped in some dukkha, some moment of difficulty, some tension, And it's going to happen all the time. We're going to be in tension, dukkha, something's not right, I got to fix it, there's a problem, our boat is going to get stuck down there. In that moment, when there is that feeling of being stuck in some tension, some dukkha, some irritation, it's in that moment we want to begin to look for impermanence. We want to get used to understanding that the stuckness is our resistance to the natural flow of life. And that resistance usually means that we are expecting something to be permanent, but it's not. Expecting something to satisfy us because it did before, but it doesn't. Or taking something as a personal attack on me, and it's not. These kinds of ways that we hold our understanding in this absoluteness is where the tension begins to come. So our practices around impermanency and loss is really to help us see it as part of a natural flow in our everyday life. So we talked about three of them last week, but I want to talk more this week about the contemplations on death. So the three that we talked about last week is, first is this five recollections. People practice with these five recollections all the time. Every day they say, they practice with them like they do the precepts as a regular part of understanding practice from time to time. And it's very simple. The Buddha said to recollect on it daily. But the recollections is just reminding ourselves that we are of the nature to get ill. We're of the nature to get sick. And that there's no one and nothing that can prevent that from happening. No, we don't have, it doesn't matter if we eat right, get enough exercise, watch out for viruses, wearing my mask, 6 feet, all of that. We are of the nature to get sick, to get ill. And gravely ill at that. And there's nothing and no one that can change that. We are of the nature to grow old. And we are of the nature to die. Nothing and no one can change those three processes of illness, aging, and death. It is the nature of our human bodies. It is a natural aspect of life. Oftentimes, it's kind of strange the older we get, the more it's weird that we all of a sudden seem old. I've been looking in the mirror every day my entire life, and I'm shocked sometimes when I look at myself and say, oh my God, you're so much older. It really hit me when I stopped coloring my hair. Then all of a sudden it was like, what happened? When did I get gray hair? When did that happen? Nothing's wrong. But it's just the nature of it. You know, it's been happening all along, but you see how if I color my hair, I don't have to see that happening. And somehow I get a sense that it's not actually happening, but it is. So there's another piece though. It's not just this body is of the nature to grow old and die, but that everything that's dear to us is subject to change. It's subject to loss, and there's nothing that no one can do about that either. Everything that we hold dear, whether it's my favorite cup or my partner or our kids or whatever, there is everything that we get attached to is subject to change. And in that change, it's subject to vanish and disappear. And the more we come to terms with the understanding that everything in our lives is subject to this conditioning and changing of conditions, the more we can learn to feel into that perception of impermanence or loss when it begins to happen, without being so reactive, like we're so upset that something has changed. We get so upset at something has changed, as if somehow or another, I can demand that things stay the way they should stay. We cannot. We can try, but it's a little hard to control. So sometimes we can control it, but unless we're forever demanding, it's going to change. And the last thing is that the only thing we can be responsible for is our own actions. That's it. And we are responsible for our own actions. And it is this nature of, if we do something, whether it's virtuous or not, we're going to be responsible for the impact of that, as long as there's an impact to be had. I remember thinking one time, that seems like permanent. You know, how come everything else is going away? But when it comes to my actions, I'm like locked into them for permanent, forevermore. And the more way to see this as impermanent is, a teacher explained to me that when we do actions, we think the action is right now and that's the end of it. Okay, whew, I dodged that bullet. It's all over, permanent. It just happened and then that's it. But that's not the truth of it. It moves. And in the impermanent nature of movement, the movement of that is where the impact shows up. That's what we have to be familiar with, that things are not solid, permanent. I did that yesterday and now it's over with. The movement of that is still flowing, and the impact of it is still flowing into the rest of the world. So I like saying these five reflections every day, but I do them with chants so that it uplifts the heart, and at the same time, I take them, I get connected to them. And that's what we were trying last week, was to see these with the uplift of a heart chant. And then I did this modified Tonglen with taking the eight worldly winds and breathing in the unpleasant portion of it and letting go of the pleasant portion. So there's a way in which we want to be able to breathe in and transform unpleasant dukkha, and at the same time, we do not want to hold on to the pleasure. We want to let that go. So we let go, breathe out whatever gains or positive implications of conditions, and we breathe in whatever negative it is. And so it's just this breathing in, breathing out, breathing in, breathing out, eight worldly winds. That's pleasure and pain, gain and loss, praise and blame, and fame and ill repute. And so the fame and ill repute is not whether you're famous like some movie star, but famous in your own family, in your own job. Everybody likes me. So sometimes everybody's going to like you and sometimes not. So we just want to learn how to breathe this in and breathe it out, breathe it in and breathe it out, to get used to the truth that there are these eight worldly winds that are constantly blowing around our lives. It's constant. You could actually all day long note which worldly wind is this, and you will notice that it's constant all day. One of these worldly winds is showing up. And then there's the sitting with the grief, so sitting in the bones of grief. And that is this practice where you, I just connect with some grief, some loss, some sadness, and I just sit here with it like a practice, like I'm going to be with this loss and be with this sadness to practice with it. Where is it in the body? How do I feel it? What is this actually? What is this pain? What is this loss? What is it? It's a kind of contemplating and looking into the nature of grief without trying to get rid of it. I'm actually just sitting with something I lost or sitting with something that I wish were not to be and just being with it. So that brings me to this contemplation on death. And there is no better teacher I have not heard who talks about death as well and as deep as Venerable Nalio. He really spends a great deal of time talking about death. It's a lot. So I just want to cover three ways that he talks about death that I think any one of these practices can help us. Begin to see, or remember, it's helping us perceive the lawfulness of impermanence in our everyday life. This is what we're trying to see, the lawfulness of impermanence in our everyday life. So first, there is the practice of the anatomical parts, 32 parts. So it's breaking the body down into 32 parts. I'm not going to read the sutta for it, but the body itself is not just contained as this whole body, but it is broke down into all kinds of little bits and pieces. And the more you can see that the body is bits and pieces that have come together, the less attached you get to the wholeness of this body as one thing. So there are all these organs, all these different fluids, all these different parts of us, all this various types of fluids from everything from saliva to urine to pus to blood, all kinds of parts in liquidity, all kinds of solids like arms and legs and muscles and all kinds of squishy things like organs and hearts and livers and stomachs and all these different little parts that make us up, and very hard things like fingernails and bones and things like that. So you see there's all the hairs on the pubic hairs on the head, hairs in the eyelashes, hairs in the arms, hairs in the legs. So what the Buddha did was he would sit and contemplate in great detail all these different aspects of the body so that he could begin to see that this body is really not this solid form that we tend to think of it as. The way that Anallio does this, I think, is very, very helpful. He takes the anatomical parts, but he does it and bakes it into three parts, basically. He does it as your flesh, your skin, your flesh, and your bones. So you just kind of get a sense of the felt sense of skin and the felt sense of flesh, the fleshy parts in the body, and then the felt sense of bones. The way Philip Moffat took this is one of the ways that we go into the physical body as part of nine bodies, is you begin to feel your way into the heaviness of the body. What you feel is heavy, the heavy, firm solidness of the body. And when you get a sense of that heaviness, the groundedness of this moment, heavy body sitting here, it's not some light body you hold up, but when you actually relax, the body is heavy. And that heaviness is also attached to the hardness of the bones. So it doesn't matter how soft our body is flesh-wise, we can still feel the hardness of the bones, the sit bones when we're sitting, or our feet on the floor, or our hands touching each other. I can feel the soft, fleshy part of my fingertips, but I can also feel the hardness of the bone. And so this feeling into the skin, the flesh, and the bones is a way of helping us see the various parts that make up a body. But it's not one, it's parts that come together. Another way to begin to think about this is to notice meat at a grocery store. This might be weird for those of you that are vegetarians, but go to the grocery store and look at the meat, right? Because each one of those pieces of meat is part of an animal at some point, but when it's in the store, it's meat, which is why the Buddha did not, it's one of the reasons why he didn't require his monks and nuns to be vegetarians. You can look at the different various cuts of meat and you can see that you can see the various parts of it, and in and of itself, it doesn't look like a body. But when you put all those parts together, it begins to look like a body, like it's a thing, but there's no center core there. So that's what this paying attention to the parts are. Along with this paying attention to the parts is that the parts themselves, the body itself, is organic matter. So it decomposes. It disintegrates. And so our bodies, go on YouTube and watch videos. They have slow motion videos that show you the decomposing body of an animal or a bird, or you can see the decomposingness of a human body. But you want to begin to see that not only is this body itself part of a different parts that make up a whole, and it's all put together in this sack called skin, but also that this body will decompose, that it will disintegrate. We can see that in our own ages, that it, as we age, the body is disintegrating and decomposing. But there are various stages of decomp that you could begin to look at. So why would this contemplation on this level of death be important? And it goes to, we are going to die. And part of the difficulty with dying is that we don't want to lose ourselves. But in some respects, there is no self there. There are our ideas, our views, our opinions, our memories, and we clump all that together in these mental formations, feeling tones, five aggregates, and we call this me. But learning to begin to see just how disjointed that is, then we can be more patient with this body and its changing nature. A way to watch decomp besides the videos, I have put food in a container and watched it, get destroyed. It's pretty gross, so you gotta really be up on it. You gotta have some wits about you, and you can tolerate flies, and there are all kinds of things that begin to happen. I still, every once in a while, when I go to eat fruit, I'm like, is the maggots already in the fruit, or what the hell? What are these little fruit flies? Where do they come from? Are they in the fruit, or are they not in the fruit? So I'm just saying, you got to be careful with the mind and where it's going to go when it starts watching what happens to decomposing food. And don't use McDonald's French fries. They don't decompose. I don't know what that's all about. They really are good, but, they're not going to decompose. So something's wrong with that. And you don't want to get caught into wondering What exactly is that material if it doesn't ever decompose? I don't know. But then he comes up with another way of, I mean, all of this is in the Satipatthana. He just articulates it with much more brevity. So the next part about it is our own mortality, not the decomposing nature of the body, but our mortality itself. And a part of that mortality is you can imagine your breath as being the very last breath. And the way that I have found to best help me kind of get a sense for this is to breathe, allow yourself to do an inhale that's normal, and then exhale very slow, let all the air exhale out. And you'll begin to feel this earnestness to take a breath in, but just keep letting the breath slowly exhale. And you can feel that need to take another breath. And that need to take another breath is the need for life. And then you slowly breathe out, last breath, last breath, last breath, last breath. It helps us see more directly this possibility of the fact that this could be my last breath. Another way is to contemplate, what if I died right now? Just that concept. What if I died right now? What would that mean? I have thought about it, you know, like driving, and what if I had a heart attack right now? And imagining the damage that would come from the cars hitting, or just the contemplating of what you're trying to see, I think, is that many times what we think is really, really, really important becomes less important if you do what Rodney always suggested, hold it up against your own impending death. So if you think some argument is really, really important with your neighbor about their stupid mask, you hold that up against you're about to die today. Do you really want to spend that last day having that same old conversation you've had like 9,000 times with that person about the whole pandemic and the truth of it or not? Is that really where you want to spend your life? You won't. When you're actually looking at death, what becomes real and important and of value is your internal values. And we are less frivolous with what we do with time. So the contemplation on our own mortality is designed not to be morbid, but to get us to realize that some things just aren't important. You can have it. Okay, fine. You know, if that's the way you're, if it's that much, okay, we're going with you. So contemplating, what if I died in this moment, or this was my last breath, things like that. That is a way to help us, you know. There is a program, I don't know who's a teacher, that it's a year to die, a year to live, and you contemplate the coming demise over the course of a year. And a few people I've seen, I know, that have done that said it really triggered them into understanding what is really important to me in my life and what is not. And so that's also a possibility. The last thing is this thinking about the dissolution of earth and water and fire and wind. Stephen Levine, thank you, Jean. The dissolution of earth is recognizing that the earth, our bodies are going to disseminate, and they're going to go away. At some point, we're not going to be able to move the body as much. The dissolution of water is we begin to get dry mouth. And so you can just imagine when you need to take some water and you're thirsty, that the water dries up out of the body. Or when your limbs are achy and sore, that this body actually has a dissolution that comes with it. When you get thirsty, water is leaving the body. When you urinate and the feces, you're thinking about, oh, this is water moving out of the body, waste moving out of the body, or fire. It has to, you know, when you die, your extremities begin to get colder and colder and colder. So we lose the passion. We lose the fire, the heat in our body, until wind is the last dissolution of breath being taken away. So those are all ways that we can contemplate our own, the demise of the body. The last thing I want to say before we take a break and then break out into groups is that it's not just knowing we're going to die. It's the knowing that there's no you to die. I hope I can help you hear that. That the more you contemplate on all these things we're talking about, the more you begin to see that it's not you. That there's something that makes us alive. There's something that makes us individuals, but it is not the body. It is not our opinions. It is not the life we lived, our memories. It's not the feeling tones. It's not all the fact that we even have consciousness. There's something that we are alive. And we know we are alive versus something that's dead. We know when something is alive and when something is dead. But it is not the thing. And so there's a quality of emptiness and less attachment that can come when we practice on these death contemplations, that we can become freer with the world as it is, freer with the possibility of life unfolding in changing strange ways that I can't control. So anyway, I want to take a break. I'm so sorry I went over. I really expected to go quicker than that, but you know, I never go quick. I try to, it just doesn't happen. So let's take 5 minutes and then come back and we'll break up into groups. All I want you to think about is all of the practices you've heard, what seems to resonate the most with you? What seems to resonate as a way that you think you could practice beginning to perceive impermanence and death? All right, so I'll open all the rooms and call you back in about 10 minutes. So let's see if what you think. Oh, go ahead. Is it Bruce or Shawnee? Go ahead. Can you unmute there? Let me see. Yeah, you should. Yeah, there you go.
Okay. So you were talking before we went into the breakout rooms about there's no me to die.
Was that?
Could you? I mean, I feel both Sean and I say we've been practicing for a long time. We've gone, what's she talking about? You say, well, I mean, when you were talking to me, I was sitting here thinking, huh? Well, what? What are you talking? So, could you talk some more about it?
It is the concept of non-self. Meaning that we think you take the body, you take my memories, my thoughts about things, my opinion, my views. I feel pleasant, unpleasant, and neutral, and I know what's going on. I got some consciousness here. You take all of that together and this perception that I am a separate individual. And all I was pointing to is that the more you begin to dissolve this glued together self, the more you can begin to realize that you are not your memories. You are not just the physical body, because if you lost certain body parts, you would still be you. If you lost your memories, you would still be you. If you were numb and couldn't feel pleasant or unpleasant, you would still be you. So the thing that makes you you is not the body itself. And so that's what I mean by there's no me that dies. There's no me. The part that makes me is not connected. I mean, it lives within the context of a body, but it's not the body. That's what I was pointing to. It's more of the non-self awareness that we can practice with.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
I'm still confused. This is the other half here, Sean.
Yeah, Sean.
All right, so I get what you just said, but also the construct of me, the personality, the whole ball of wax that I've become, that dies. That's when I'm dead, that part is also dead.
And that's right.
There's somebody around that might remember the construct of Sean.
Yes.
In their own mind. True. But basically, all of me is just gone. The body's gone. The thing that I think I am and identify with, it's all G-O-N-E gone.
It's all gone. What the Buddha was pointing to was, though, that none of that is you. The body's gone, but that body's not you. Because right. Parts of your body can be taken away, and it's still you, whatever the you is that's you. And you can lose your memory. People that have dementia or Alzheimer, I can look at my mother and I still see mama. Even though there's no memory there, it's still mama. But yet, she is not the memory. So what makes us us is not the fact that we have memories, which can go, the fact that we have a body, which can disintegrate, the fact that we feel things, which we could lose our nerve endings, and like the people with MS, they lose their nerve endings and they don't have feeling like that, but they're still them. All of that, what he was pointing to, all of that that dies is not you. It's a being, which is true, and it is a body, which is true. There is a body here. I do have memories. There are sensations that I have, and all of that is real, and it's there. But just because it's there, it doesn't mean this is the sum total of me. There is something else in me, and you really notice it if you've ever noticed a dead body. There is no person within that body, even though the body is still there. There's something else that's gone. And that's what he was pointing to, that this body is not us. There's something else that's there. And that, what we call life, is not you. It's not your memories and the physical sensation, the physical makeup of your body. So there's a spark there that I don't know what that is. That's what I was pointing to.
Well, I don't know what it is either.
I don't either.
It's not a McDonald's French fry, though.
No, it is definitely not a McDonald's French fry. Because those things, I don't know what those things are, but... Yeah. I don't know why they taste so good, but they do not disintegrate. You can find a McDonald's fries in your car that's been there for 20 years. It still looks the same.
So is this part that we don't know what it is? Like, I was with my dad when he died.
Yes.
And the dad that I knew who had dementia when he died, yep. I watched him go bit by bit over seven years.
That's right.
And then he went completely and the breath went out. And he obviously was not there anymore. But I don't know where he went.
No, we don't. We don't. But what made him was not the body you were looking at. That's what the Buddha was pointing to.
You're right. No, it wasn't him.
That was not him.
He lives inside of me.
Yes, it's something, but it was not the physical body you see. Mm-hmm. It's not the feeling tones. It's not the memories. It's not that. And the more we get used to and comfortable around the notion of impermanence, then you can step more closely into a world of the deathless, because you could let the physical body die and begin to know that that is not you. And that physical body changes, it moves, it shifts, it dies, it does all kinds of things. But whatever makes us is something other than the body.
Mm. So there's possibly some freedom in that.
That's what it was pointing to.
Yeah.
That the freedom exists because we are not tied to this physical body that is always shifting and changing.
Well, thank you.
That brings some happiness to me.
It does.
Yeah.
It's different. It's not the sense of when this body dies, it's all over. That's why people that practice with the death meditations, the practice of impermanence leads us to the deathless, not the morbidity of just, oh, I'm just going to die and that's just it. But the more you begin to contemplate death and the people you've seen who have died and the dead bodies you've seen, and like, wait, there's no person in there. I see the body is there and I know the body is there and I know that's what my mom looked like. But clearly, whoever my mom is, she's not in there. That somehow there is a distinction between life itself and the body. And that distinction, we begin to see that the body is impermanent, but life itself is not. Great.
Thank you.
You're welcome. Yeah, Beth. And then I'll get you, Kathy. Just let me get Beth here.
Our my dyad partner and I were it's amazing how these things come up sometimes. We had similar experiences recent with really the gift of traveling along with a parent who's aging and watching that process happen. I just got back from helping my mother start closing down her house, and the five recollections are really useful. They really helped my, I guess you'd call it, interpersonal mindfulness with my mom. She's not on the path, but she's been aware of these very useful reminders. Down to there was an example of a precious teapot. There was a discussion about whether or not the teapot can go, and there's memories about the teapot, and I felt that that rub of acknowledging that this has to move forward, but that not wanting it to move.
Yes.
And that is that self-concern, that sort of reifying. Not only do I want it to be, and it's comforting, of course, and the memory, I don't want it to move forward.
Yes, that's right.
I do and not want to move forward. She doesn't want to move forward.
That's right.
Years ahead of
but
me.
The practice that we're learning is that there's no right or wrong. We are undertaking this practice to learn to be with the reality of that tension, because as householders, that's the tension we all feel all the time. We feel that all the time. It's part of our birthright as being householders, it's not the same for monastics. And monastics are trained and try to spend their lives not being attached to anything. But as householders, we are going to be attached to many, many, many things. And we are not trying to say, okay, I'm not attached to nothing. I don't care. I don't care. I don't care. We're not doing that. We are practicing with right where you're at, that line. Like, oh, I see the tug of not wanting this to move and the reality of knowing things move on, and seeing that. And so some things you might say, oh, I'm going to keep this teapot a little bit longer, you know, and you keep it, but you know the truth of it. That's what you're trying to see. You see the truth of it and not, and it may be like when my mother died, you know, she used to do a lot of, she had a lot of china, you know, collected it over the years. So we're like trying to get rid of all these dishes and, oh my God. And so all the little things that I liked, I would take. And, oh, and then when I was living in this place, I put the boxes over here and then I moved them over there. And then, you know, I finally, I had moved these boxes so many times and never used the dishes anymore. My mother used them, right? We didn't use them. I just had mama's dishes. I finally said, I think it's time for these dishes to go on to the goodwill. And I let them go. But it did take a while of moving them from here to there, to rearranging, trying to make space for the dishes. And then eventually I could let go of them. They were no longer tied to mama, is what I realized. For a while there, they were very close to mama, like these were mama's dishes. But after I began to move the boxes in my house, and I never used them, they just became boxes of dishes that I needed. I need that space for something else that's more connected to me, and not these boxes of dishes. And they weren't even mama's dishes anymore. So some of that, we got to watch that unfolding that we begin to see. And that's what helps us. So the practice is not to force yourself to let go of that attachment, but to acknowledge these attachments, hold on to them if you need to, and watch and see if it changes over time. What would it take for it to let go? And when do you let go of it? When is it no longer our teapot? And it's just a teapot. Kathy?
You said a moment ago something, we're kind of getting to it here, but I always wondered about this. The impermanence leads to the deathless.
Yeah, that's the same thing I was talking to Shawnee and Bruce about.
Well, what exactly does that mean? I mean, there's something that doesn't die.
Yes.
It's impermanent.
It's impermanent.
Mm-hmm. Impermanence can't die?
It's not impermanent. It is unconditional. So our bodies are conditional. They exist because of a series of conditional operations that are happening within the body. The heart has to pump the blood and the nerve endings have to work and there has to be a spark of understanding in the mind or whatever. I mean, there's things that come together to make our bodies work. It's conditional. Anything that's conditional is subject to change. And if it's subject to change, it is subject to loss. Gain and loss, the eight worldly winds. It's subject to that. Pleasure, pain, all of that. But there is an aspect of being. The Buddha did not call it a soul. He did not believe that there was some soul or spirit that carries from life to life. The way that Venerable Nalio articulated this is probably, I hope I'm not going too far out there, but this is the way he articulated it to our training cohort. And I totally believe this. So the reason why the Buddha talked on karma is because our actions have impact, and that impact is what moves. So when we do actions, the impact of that action is carried on until it dissolves. And so the way that Venerable Analio explained it to us is he said that imagine there's a fire in California and the fire is burning this tree. So how does the fire that's burning this tree get across the street to the part of land over there? It is carried on the wind from one to the other. And that is what he says karma does. Karma gets carried on the winds from one place to another. Gets carried on the wind. This is not the same fire that is burning the tree over there. It's not like this fire gets carried. We don't see the fire like, oh, there's the fire. It's going over across the sky, across the street, and over there. It's not the same fire like that. But it is the spark or the remnants, the heat of fire gets carried on the wind, and it lands across the street. Likewise, the reason why paying attention to our current life becomes so important is because the impact of our behavior gets carried on the winds into the rest of the world. And it carries with us. It's not just the impact of negative things. It's the impact of positive things. So even if I believe this, it doesn't matter to me how harmful other people are. I will always do virtuous acts over and 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 over. I don't even care. I don't even think about it. I'm going to do virtuous acts over and over and over, because that virtuous acts is carried off into the wind, and I believe it will have the impact of supporting and helping many beings to come. And so that's what I do. I just live in the day for doing virtuous acts to carry on the wind. That's what we're doing. Not worrying so much about how we live and whether things go right, because all those things are all subject to change. They're all conditional. Maybe things go okay. Maybe I wake up feeling good. Maybe I don't. Who knows? These are all conditional. But the thing that stays with us is our karma, and that's our activity, our actions, our virtuous actions. And so we just do them all the time, everything. I don't care. Open the door for everybody. Just stand there and open the door if you can. Come on in. You next. Come on in. Just pay somebody else's ticket. Who knows? You just pay it forward. Just say whatever that person's bill is, I'm paying that, you know? Like when you're standing in line to get some food, let me pay for their bill too. It's the virtuosity that we don't realize is also carried into the future over and over, over and over and over. You see? And that's the deathless. That's what we're saying is our virtuous acts never die. They continue on, continue on. And they add good energy, goodwill. There's a phrase that says that monks and nuns bring, what do they bring? They bring, I don't know, I can't remember. But it basically is saying they bring goodness into the world. So by their acts of virtuousness, their metta, their acts of kindness, they bring goodwill and joy into the world over and over and over. And as lay practitioners, we do the same thing. Every time we do a virtuous act, we're bringing that energy into the world over and over and over and over. Okay?
Thank you.
You're welcome. Beautiful. Who knew that we would end? Thank you, Kathy. Who knew we'd end on such a beautiful point from speaking about death, that it's so, you know, so warm right here. So this is the perfect place to stop. Thank you so much. Thank you. I just want to say that this is also the point of Sangha. See, we couldn't come to this place that we're at if we didn't all kind of talk it through. What do you mean? Well, what about this? And what about that? And share all of that layering is what helps us all settle down into the Dhamma. It's all of that. It's why I think Thich Nhat Hanh was spot on when he said the next Buddha will be Sangha. And we, you know, this American Buddhist kind of exercise in getting together, meditating, Dhamma talks, and then sharing it. There's something about this that is really bringing the Dhamma alive. I love it. So, this are virtuous acts. We are generating good energy for the world. Thank you so much.